I'd like to introduce Carl Freeman from Axis ILS. He's going to be moderating the panel, and he'll introduce you to the other speakers. So over to you, Carl.
Thanks, Steve. So we have a great panel before you today. Benjamin Baltazar, head of non-life underwriting pricing at Credit Suisse Insurance Link Strategies. Rebecca Boll, who's the head of industry engagement at CyberCube. We have Joe Gottlieb, who's partner for Sidley Austin's insurance practice, and Richard Penne, the CEO of ILS at Aon Securities. So we have five different perspectives: sponsor, investor, modeler, deal counsel, broker-dealer. We want to bring these different perspectives together so we can discuss cyber, something that we all think is a very important opportunity for us, for the market. I really think that there's a great chance that this could be a new big thing. We'll see. We heard some differing opinions earlier. But we'll talk about what it's going to take to bring a 144A cyber cap onto the market. Since the beginning of ILS, we've had really two peak perils that were predominant: U.S. hurricane, U.S. earthquake. Over time, we brought some diversification to the market through additional perils: hurricane and earthquake from different regions, European windstorm, life mortality, U.S. severe thunderstorm, winter storm, wildfire, to name a few. But none of them, by themselves or even in the aggregate, have been able to compete with those two peak perils, U.S. hurricane and earthquake. However, we think cyber could be that third peak peril in time. Now, it's going to take some work. But we have a lot of things that are leading us in that direction. For example, insurers are taking advantage of great opportunities in the market for growth, but they need capacity, additional capacity beyond what they can get through the traditional markets. The aggregation of cyber risk is such that we really need excess of loss solutions, such as those that could be provided by the cap on market. The models are available. Now, they're young, but no more so than the property models were when we introduced them to the cap on space. And importantly, I really think investors could use a third peak peril to take some pressure off of those two that we have. And I think the additional revenue that could be generated would more than compensate for the increase in the risk metrics, whether TVAR, PML, or others. So with that, Richard, if you wouldn't mind starting us off, give us some background. Where is cyber today, and where do you see it leading?
Yes, I think we had a question in the last panel there where the open question is there investor appetite for cyber? And I think to your point, Kyle, we are in the very, very early days of cyber insurance just generally, but more so for the ILS market. That being said, to your point, we do foresee that that there is a substantial growth opportunity within the ILS market regarding cyber. And so if we think about cyber insurance today, premiums globally are probably in the range of about $12 to $15 billion. But that's being sustained at the moment. It's being sustained in the insurance market, into the reinsurance market. The challenge is not today. The challenge is in the future, whereby we project that cyber premiums will continue to grow at a rate of about 20% per annum for the foreseeable future. And with increasing premiums comes increasing risk. And the balance sheets today of the insurers and the reinsurers are only so large. And given that many of those insurers and reinsurers that have exposure to cyber are happy where they're at, It does mean that the industry as a whole will be limited in its growth to the extent that new capital doesn't get attracted to the space, and particularly the ILS market doesn't ultimately get there. So I think generally speaking, what we'd say, Kyle, is there are many insurers out there that have had growth strategies for the last decade or so in cyber. They've done relatively well. And now they're looking for the reinsurance market and the ILS market to ultimately, drive it forward in terms of providing risk capacity that will allow them to continue that growth.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. And Rebecca, one of the key things you have to have before you can bring a new peril to the market, to the cap on space, the models.
Right.
So where do you think we stand in terms of the market's ability to utilize models to analyze cyber risk?
Yeah, so I think it's in your introduction, Kyle, you kind of said the modeling space for cyber is still young, but I think, you know, it is maturing rapidly. You know, the cyber modelers have been around now for about 8 years. There are kind of really three main modelers now that are being used in market. And each of those three main modelers have produced at least kind of five versions of their models. So there is real investment going into developing these models, and they are maturing rapidly. That said, there's obviously still work to do. There's uncertainty inherent in every model, and certainly when you're at the earlier stages of assessing a peril. I think in terms of just quickly on the sort of, you know, the development where we've come in those 8 years, I think we've really moved from a very simplistic, kind of deterministic, aggregated market share sort of view of catastrophe in cyber, and really develop very credible data sets. They're driven by better mapping and tracking of technology dependencies, data capture, and I think have really enabled us to build scenario-based models built on credible data sets that we are then sort of validating in the market. So I think the sort of summation of that is that the models now are being used to sort of understand the tail, understand where that risk lies and where the uncertainties are. I'd like to just quickly kind of come back to actually to a point that Raffaele made in the previous panel, and a theme that I think ran through the previous panel as well, and that was kind of that iPhone analogy of there's a lot of very complicated, very detailed sort of parts that go into an iPhone, but actually what we need to sort of present to the market is that beautiful, sleek box that everyone covers. And I think that sort of, you know, with cyber, there is a lot going on under the surface, and I think we'll pick up at some of those themes that are being brought into modelling cyber through the conversation today. But really want to present that sort of confidence in the work that is going into the cyber modelling, the decisions that we're able to make on the back of the data and analytics that is being provided, it is enabling the market to make those risk transfer decisions.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Rebecca. One of the really critical aspects of bringing a new peril to the market is we need to know what's being covered, what events are going to be in, what events are going to be out. In order to do that, you need to have well-developed, well-thought-out, very specific event definitions. Joe, what are your thoughts on the considerations involved in developing those sets of event definitions?
Yeah, sure. Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're good.
So it's pretty similar on a basic level to NatCat, what we currently have in the catastrophe bond market. You have to define the event, and you have to define the date of loss, and that's how you get your covered event. But obviously, it's relatively easy to see when a hurricane hits the coast of Florida. You don't need pages and pages of definitions to define that. I think what you're going to see in the cyber market is it's just more complex, and you have to figure out a lot of the nuance and develop more complex and nuanced definitions to cover that. So, for example, so on the cyber side, so what's an event, first of all? So it's a, let's say, a systemic cyber event. So what is a systemic cyber event? So let's say an easy case of just there's a hacking group that affects a cloud service provider, and just there's a bunch of entities that are affected by that. So maybe that's easy, everybody can see it. But what if there's a hacking group out there that systematically targets a bunch of companies, gets malware into all these different companies' systems, and kind of triggers it all the same day, or let's say something like a software vulnerability, not even malicious, like a Y2K scenario, if you remember that. So are these systemic, could these be systemic cyber events if they cause sufficient amount of losses? So you have to consider all that. As part of that, so let's just say something that you might see, which might be common here, is let's say two, we'll call cyber loss occurrences or more that have the same originating cause. So cyber loss occurrence being, you know, malware, data exfiltration, data breach, all that stuff. But what does that mean even to say it's the same originating cause? So now you have to have rules around that. So maybe you'll say, well, let's look, is there a single point of failure? Do you have maybe non-targeted actions? So, for example, if you have, like the case we said before, where there's a hacker group that kind of systematically targets a bunch of companies, maybe you won't group those together to be a single originating cause. So it's just, then there could be exceptions to the exceptions, and it's just something you have to poke and prod at when you're putting together these definitions, which, as you can see, have to be more nuanced than on the NatCat side. And then you get to the date of loss question. So, again, a hurricane hits the coast of Florida. You can see when it hits the coast of Florida. Here, you can have malware reside in people's systems for years before even discovering it. So you have to have rules in place also to define how do you get the date of loss. So say, I guess the two common ways for at least on the cyber loss occurrence side that you evaluate a date of loss are claims-based and discovery-based. So first-party liability, first-party claims, it's usually based on date of discovery, and third-party based on when the claim is made. But in any event, so now you're talking about defining the date of the loss for a particular cyber loss occurrence or claim, and then you have to put that within the context of the systemic cyber event itself, right? Because that's the equivalent of the hurricane, right? That's what we're talking about figuring out a date of loss for. And why does that matter? Because if your date of loss is before or after a risk period, you could collect or not collect. Or let's say it's at one annual risk period where you have a much higher attachment than the second annual risk period. So it's really consequential when you have the actual date of loss of the systemic cyber event. So then you have to figure out, all right, so we have all these pieces of it that could be at different times. So where do we actually place the systemic cyber event? Maybe your solution will be to take the earliest one, and it's something objective. But you don't want to leave that to some discretion at the end, because investors may not like at the end if you just decide, you know what, I will choose this event because, and that will be our date because that puts us in the right annual risk period. So these are just considerations you have to think about. Ultimately, a lot that goes into it are the, what coverages the seeding company needs, what investors are looking to accept, and also, very importantly, what's being modeled.
Thanks, Joe. And Benjamin, from the investor perspective, are there specific types of events that should or shouldn't be included? In particular, how should we think about war, attacks on infrastructure, and even phishing campaigns?
Yeah, thanks, Kai and Joe. What investors don't like is losses, but they also don't like surprises. And that's where the event definition is really important, because if you invest in a cyber burn and you expect to cover cyber outage, you don't want that some scenario that wasn't seen by anyone is then triggering the loss, because there's already so much uncertainty on other parts of the structure of the transaction. So that's really one thing where investors will focus on really understanding the and making sure they understand the type of event we would be covering. On things like war you mentioned, you have the dilemma that we don't want to cover war, but at the same time on a cyber event, it's unlikely that a state would claim in the public that they would have done the attack. So then it makes it difficult to really identify on whether that was a war claim or not. There are many other aspects as well, which is coming on the modeling side on are we modeling what the event definition is then is worded. Do we have the same type of structure? And it opens the door to what are the assumptions taken around that. And that's also very important to understand from that perspective on the modeling side. Then there's also the question of, I think it was mentioned several times in the first panel, about trust. That's a recurring word in the ILS industry. As investor, we want to also have trust that the sponsor, the seeding company, understand what they are doing. We want to feel comfortable that they really have an assessment of what keeps them awake at night. Is it really the cloud outage? Is it something else that keeps them awake at night? Do they want the cover for everything, but then you enter the territory of they don't really know what keeps them awake at night? There are ways also to address it by not making the transaction on a ultimate net loss basis, so not indemnity. You can think about parametric structure, maybe model structure. That's things I think when first the property cat bond were done, they were on a modeled or parametric basis, so that's also one way to remove some of the uncertainty. That's a lot of uncertainty, especially the event definition, sorry, the modeling, and really the trust in the data that's also provided to us when we're looking at the transaction.
Rebecca, please.
Yeah, just on the modeling point and sort of what is being modeled, I think, you know, across the modeling sector for cyber is sort of really coalescing around certain kind of peak perils, if you like, and peak exposures, to use that NatCat terminology. So the peak perils, you know, data breach, cloud outage, ransomware, malware, are really sort of the three core perils that can cause that real tail losses. And the exposures there, those technologies that permeate across enterprises, across industries and regions, include the cloud service providers, the operating systems providers, for example. So I think, you know, we're coalescing around those perils and exposures and creating kind of event families of different scenarios that we can play against those and modeling those, which I think helps with that event definition conundrum there. Mm-hmm. So just want to clarify that.
So Richard, just, you know, yep, piecing together some of the comments we've just heard, want to trust that investors are comfortable and understand the risk they're taking on. The models are looking at those peak sub-perils within cyber, data exfiltration, malware, cloud outage. Does it make sense to limit the scope of at least the initial set of transactions to just those pieces or some subset? We've heard yep, you know, cloud outage can be addressed parametrically. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so if we hear what Joe and Rebecca are talking about, I mean, we are of the view that this is doable. You know, there is a lot of work getting done within the industry from the insurers, the reinsurers, and the ILS banks involved to really ring fence and put around event definitions and coverage terminology that we ultimately feel gets the seeding company's coverage, but also enables entities like CyberCube and Rebecca's team to ultimately categorize and quantify risk at the end of the day. So I think first and foremost, we fundamentally feel that there is a way forward in defining this risk and ultimately getting it to the investors. I think from our side, there are clearly opportunities within a parametric and a modeled loss world. But that being said, the fundamental tenet of insurance is the ultimate net loss. It's indemnity coverage. And to the extent that event definitions, underlying subject business, can ultimately be defined and in turn there's sufficient expertise around the modelling, we don't see an impediment to ultimately doing an indemnity-based product.
And just from the sponsor's perspective, you know, clearly sponsors want as much coverage as possible. If at all possible, they'd like to have it mirror what they get in the traditional markets. But understand there are some limitations, either in drafting event definitions that are all-encompassing or investor appetite and modeling constraints. So, Richard, I'm going to stay with you on the structural features that we needed. It doesn't seem like we can take a set of event definitions and an existing set of offering materials, slap them together, and you're done. We're going to need to make some modifications to handle some of the peculiarities of cyber. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think the basic framework of a cat bond holds for cyber, meaning, as we've discussed, there's the coverage components, there's the reinsurance agreement, which is fundamental to any indemnity-based cat bond. And then there is the risk categorization. And so fundamentally, those components all exist, and we would imagine that they're part and parcel of a 144A cat bond. In terms of the overall structure, we think it's ultimately pretty consistent with the bond market. But it comes down to the detail. It comes down to the content and articulating this exposure sufficiently to the investors. And it all seems pretty difficult in many senses. But at the end of the day, and you touched on it in your introduction, this is a very important opportunity for the ILS markets, because you have a peril, let's call it a peril, that is largely not being taken up by the ILS markets to date. Historically, in the reinsurance space, cyber has been in either a quota share form, where the reinsurer is pari passu to the insurance company, or it's in some form of aggregate stop loss form. And this is a little bit different. Cyber for the ILS markets is a little bit different, because it gives the cyber investors, it gives the ILS investors the opportunity to shape the coverages that will ultimately be borne out as the industry heads inevitably to excessive loss type protections. If we go back 25 years or so in the cat bond market, the cat bond market was playing catch up to reinsurance. You know, the reinsurance market had very well defined coverages for property and for cat, as it still does today. And the cat bond market has had to sort of come along in that guise, so to speak, to offer an equivalent protection. Here, the ILS investors have the opportunity to really step up and articulate what aspects of cyber they're wanting to take and how they want to take it. And that will, in part, really help form the excess of loss cyber market in the future years.
Thanks, Richard. And Rebecca, how to phrase this? There are definitely some aspects of cyber that are different from what we typically see, property. And I do want to continue to at least investigate a little bit the different trigger mechanisms. Do you think today's cyber models can handle the different trigger mechanisms? And second question, is there anything we would need to do differently in terms of resets based on the changing nature of the risk, at least relative to the other perils, the property perils?
Right. So, in terms of the trigger mechanisms, parametric trigger, I think it's much the same as in sort of property cat in terms of the benefits of that, and you know, having that credible, independent, reliable calculation agent is obviously key. And I think, you know, those exists, and you know, an example would be monitoring a defined outage period for a cloud service provider in a defined area or region, for example, is certainly doable there today. Indices for cyber have been around since 2017. You know, PCS is out there. There are others in development or in market that are viable indices to facilitate that industry loss warranty market there. And I think as we're building that historical event data set, as we're building that claims data set over the years, those are also becoming kind of more credible. In terms of ultimate net loss, the models, as we've described, are addressing the perils and exposures there, also responding to those terms and conditions. So the models are not infinitely, but definitely extremely malleable to different insurance terms and conditions and different reinsurance structures. So you're able to apply those through the models and get a range of different outcomes there for that UNL cover. And the insurance policy, the product is still evolving as well, and so we need to have those mechanisms to be able to adjust to those different policy terms and conditions through as well.
And as far as resets are concerned, or just the term of a transaction, mm-hmm. with the ever-changing nature of the cyber risk, do you think the typical 3 to 4 year term is appropriate, or maybe something shorter?
As I kind of described as we opened, in the 8 years that cat modeling's been around, there's been 5, 6, 7 versions of each of those major cat models. So let's call that one a year of model releases for cyber. So I think that reflects that dynamic nature of cyber risk. It's a man-made peril. It's fast-moving and evolving. As we say, it is coalescing around specific perils and exposures, but all the same, there are changes that need to be reflected. So I think that would also apply on the ILS front.
Okay, thank you. Shifting gears a little bit, I do want to talk about something. It's not the most glamorous aspect of bringing a new peril to the market, but data and disclosure. I think we really have to think about this. And with something so new, I think we have the opportunity and really the obligation to take a step back and rethink how we present the information to investors in the offering materials, whether it be the subject business section, disclosure around modeling, risk factors. Joe, what are your thoughts?
So I guess fundamentally the pieces will take the format of a traditional 144A cat bond. So just picture the term sheet summary section. You have your risk factors, you have your subject business / business description, and you have your modeling and all the other stuff, all the other pieces that you put into the typical 144A offering document. So we talked about before, I think the general structure on the term side of things, early redemption events, extension events, that's going to look very similar to what investors and others are used to. Where you differ is going to be the pages of nuanced definition of the actual event and date of loss triggers and all that kind of thing. On the risk factors and generally, what I would say is important to, I guess, tell investors about certain unique aspects of cyber that you might not see in the typical NatCat market. You don't see in those risk factors. Just as an example, take the war exclusion. So it's pretty complicated. There's a lot of discussion that's been going on about the war exclusion for years now, and you know, Lloyd's proposed or came out with some wording to deal with some of the nuance. But just as an example, how do you attribute the question of attribution to a state actor attacking another country state actor? So how do you attribute that state actor as being the one who's responsible? Do you accept the victim of the cyber attack's word for it? Do you take, or is it some independent agency? Are there political considerations that might prevent some entities from even telling people where it came from, even if they know? Could it be years before it's known who actually was responsible for the actual cyber attack? And also, for war exclusion, since we're talking about that, what does that even mean, to have a war-like exclusion here? Are we talking about that there has to be a physical war, and then there's a cyber attack that kind of supports the physical war, or just a plain-on cyber attack from a state against another state? Is that sufficient? What kind of damage does it have to cause into that state? Is it something that kind of undermines state activity, like a utility or something like that? Or is it just some economic harm? Also, collateral damage. So if you have one state attack state two, and state three is where you have a lot of the victims of the cyber attack, is that something that would be excluded by the war exclusion? So when it comes back, so here's an example. So in the NotPetya case, which is the NotPetya attack, which is a 2017 attack by basically Russia against a Ukrainian software that ended up spreading around the world, essentially. So there is case law in New Jersey, at least as far as it all the way out to this year, where I think it was Merck who basically was not being paid out, and the court ruled in their favor that they should be paid out, that they wasn't excluded by the war exclusion, without getting the specifics of like what the actual wording there, because it matters what wording you have for the actual exclusion. So that's a case where you could argue that pre-2022 Russian-Ukrainian hostilities was still in the context of some sort of war. There were on the Ukrainian Eastern Front, they had been battling since 2014. So you could say, and that it probably was, it's something to support that war, or warlike action, so that's something physical there. There wasn't undermining a state utility or anything. It caused a lot of economic damage, and it did spread and cause a huge amount of economic damage throughout the world. So this is just an example. What you see from that is that interpretations could develop over time. And ultimately, from an investor perspective, or from a disclosure perspective, you want to make sure that some of these areas that are really developing where interpretations can change, you're letting investors know if that's through risk factor or subject business or whatever the case is. If the seeding company has a standard war exclusion that it uses, which may not be the case, but if it did, it's something that investors may want to know. So that's on, like, let's say, the risk factors. On the subject business and modeling, so, substantively, it's going to look, on the let's say, the subject business, which is the business description and these offering documents, right? Fundamentally, what you have there are, you know, detailed descriptions of the coverages, the policies, underwriting guidelines. You have risk management, loss reserving, historical data, and around this base. And basically, it's the same template that you would apply to the cyber world. It's just that investors probably aren't yet as educated as they are on the NatCat side of things. So you might see, at least in the initial bonds, especially on the indemnity side, is specifically what I'm referring to, a lot more detail on the coverages and the coverages and policies and whatnot, at least for the initial bonds. So overall, again, to sum it up, I think it's the template we have. It's been there for a long time. It's just that on some of the details, we're going to have to change a little bit to for the cyber world.
And I would echo the sentiment on subject business, starting with the basics. You know, here's a policy, and here are all the coverages that make up that policy, and build from there to the underwriting and underwriting management claims and so on. But the basics are going to be very key. Also on the modeling side, making sure that, you know, that everything that goes into making the model made available, maybe different or more cuts of data for the results, maybe for the exposures. I definitely think more granularity, additional details necessary. Benjamin, I want to point to you on this. What do you think investors need to get comfortable that they first understand the risk, the model, the cedents, perhaps? And is there any additional education that needs to happen before investors are at that point?
Yeah, it's education is needed for investors, that's true. Especially, we can't learn by investing. It's not the mandate from our client. So we need to invest if we are convinced about the investment. So there's a lot of education needed. One of the first reasons is it's a peril that's also much less intuitive. I mean, if you think there's a Cat 5 going to Miami, people could have a view. Maybe it's going to be $150 billion, $200 billion, but people would have a sense of feeling. If you have, I don't know, 24 hours cloud outage from Google, can anyone pick a number on what could be the industry loss? So it's a lot less intuitive to understand. So that's why you need to dig into all the different topics. You need to come back on the structure. You need to be confident that the reporting will be done correctly, and you will have the good source. You need this will have an impact on potential extensions. So maybe your bond will be locked for a longer time. On the modeling side, the transaction is brought to you with a modeling agent, and the expected loss is 2%. You need to be convinced that it's probably 2% and not 10, not 15. So on the NatCat side, obviously, we get a feeling that 2% EL for this type of structures sounds right, but for cyber, we don't know. Sometimes the argument is, yeah, it's the top layer of what I'm buying. Yeah, but if you can't really buy, you may just be a top layer of a primary layer. So we need to be convinced about the right level. We need to be convinced on the modeling side. On the modeling side, my understanding, Rebecca, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are able to tweak a lot more to select which kind of perils or scenario you cover. You can even change a bit there. I mean, so obviously the vendor models would have a view of risk, but there's a lot more things that can be done to parameterize the modeling. So that's another thing where we need to be comfortable. And then on education as well, it may be between sponsors educating us much more on what they do, but it could also be from the cyber perils in itself. It could be things done by some of the antivirus providers, so that we get a better feeling on what's happening when there's an event. One other important thing, part of the transaction is the bonds are then priced by some of the brokers, so we need to have the confidence that with available information in the market, they do also a good job at pricing it. It's a lot to educate investors on.
Absolutely.
But that's the trick ultimately, is to ensure that investors are being compensated for the risk that they're assuming. And I think it comes back to what was discussed earlier, which is the cat bond market today is vibrant, but it's dominated by a couple of perils. And to the point earlier today that having additional perils that pay a full spread or a healthy margin will be attractive to investors. And you know, we also need to think of it in the context of the overall market. So the cat bond market today is at $40 billion. We project further growth going into Q4 and then on into 2024. And, you know, a couple of hundred million here or there of cyber into the market, sort of to test out structures and to ensure that investors are understanding the structure, the coverage, and so forth. You know, it's ultimately a pretty palatable allocation to a much bigger market. So, you know, I think in many senses the ILS market has, you know, and kudos to the investors, they've approached cyber in a very cautious way. And they've not gone full guns blazing into the cyber market. They're doing it very cautiously, and we would hope these initial structures are put together in a very you know, well thought out, well considered way, where disclosures are really well documented, the modelling's state of the art to the best we understand it today, and recognising that what would trigger a cyber loss is something that is significantly larger than what we've ever seen before, and ultimately that's going to come back to pricing. It's going to be, you know, are investors getting a true risk premium for the risk that they're assuming, and is that ultimately accretive to their portfolio?
So, Richard, I definitely believe that, especially in the short term, sponsors are going to have to incentivize investors to enter this market, to put in the hard work, the sweat and the tears that go along with it. To learn about it, the models, the risk, the sponsors. So short term and long term, where do you think pricing is going to be relative to diversifiers and the peak perils?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I would say, generally speaking, cyber is a diversifying peril, but it will attract a risk premium that's much more akin to peak peril. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, that's the way it's working in the reinsurance market. So when we look at structures in the reinsurance market, they're obviously not cheap. And when we think about it in the context of just understanding the underlying risk, understanding the way in which cyber is evolving within the global economies and so forth, you know, it points to a true margin, much more akin to US hurricane than to Japanese earthquake, for example. And I think also the other part to this is how regulatory regimes will require insurers and reinsurers to provision capital for what is going to be an increasing exposure in future years. And to the extent that insurers and reinsurers are going to have to hold more capital against their cyber exposures, there's going to be an increasing willingness for them to pay up in order to get sufficient risk transfer. So, you know, I think we are relatively confident that a well-structured cyber structure will ultimately be accretive to the portfolios of investors. And, you know, and our general discussions with ILS investors today is sort of in that vein. The ILS investors are engaged. They are trying to better understand and conceive how cyber can fit within a broader ILS portfolio.
And Benjamin, just going back to some of your earlier comments, you know, what's it going to take to get investors comfortable and interested in providing that capacity? Is it just education? Is it just attractive spreads? Or is it something else?
It's a combination of everything. It's the structure. Structure has to be right. We need to be confident about the investment. It's risk spread. I mean, I think you could distinguish two type of investor. Either you have a pure cyber bond mandate, which at the moment, I mean, you don't have a universe, but maybe it will happen after this conversation. But that's a different mindset. But then if you're managing a cat bond fund and you don't have a clear mandate on cyber, but it's still possible to invest in cyber, would you want to add a cyber deal into your portfolio for the same type of multiple as you can see on the NatCat? Probably don't want, as a portfolio manager, but don't want to take the downside for the little upside. Although it's true that it's diversifying, so and I think there are debates in the industry on the proper diversification of cyber. I think what actually matters, or at least in my point of view, is you don't want a financial crisis to trigger a cyber bond, which I think we can all agree would be fine. But it's the same as then for earthquake, then financial industry wouldn't create an earthquake. So from that standpoint, it's it fits the diversification effect. I think it's also slightly more complex. You have some investors that are actually investing a tiny portion of all their assets into ILS, so they don't really have that need for diversification itself. They already consider ILS being the diversification. So to make it happen, it would really be a combination of right pricing, right structure, comfort in modeling, and on the reporting side, I would say.
And then along that diversification front, beyond just the added diversification that this peril of cyber will provide to the existing perils that are already out there, I think it's important for us to be able to find diversification within the peril itself. You know, similar to how hurricane portfolios are constructed, you might have some Texas, you might have some Florida, Northeast, and so on. Rebecca, how can the models help us find that diversification within the peril of cyber itself?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, and that exposure management's as important as risk quantification. You know, it's extremely important to find that sort of balanced portfolio. And I think the models can help at that primary underwriting decision point in terms of just providing kind of actionable insights into an individual risk, and also how that individual risk will affect the balance of a portfolio at that point of individual underwriting. So I think right from that sort of very first phase, if you like, of the process, which ultimately leads to ILS, being able to have that modeling and those actionable insights to make the right risk decisions to construct a portfolio is extremely important. And then obviously as you move to the to the reinsurance sector, that diversification of within portfolios is extremely important as well. And that diversification can take, that portfolio composition construction can take sort of different flavors, if you like. I think a really sort of strong one will be you're looking at those technology dependencies of the individual risks within a portfolio, and looking at where there are where there are connections there. So you may have a portfolio that is outsized dependent on Amazon Web Services, East Coast hubs, for example, and you may want to look at diversification there, so that any of those one single points of technology failure not be catastrophic to a portfolio. There are other examples, but mm-hmm. I think that's one where those decisions can be made, and that diversification can be found.
Okay, well, thank you, Rebecca. Thank you all, Steve. Do we have a couple minutes for questions?
We do.
So any questions from the audience?
Just probably don't need it pretty loud.
From right to left on the panel, given the chatter in the market, can you handicap for me when you think the first underwritten bond, 144A bond, will be done?
My guess is we'll have anywhere from 1 to 3, maybe more, this year. So, 2023.
Yeah, maybe.
We're ready.
I can't disagree, and even if I could say anything, I can't, because I'm a lawyer.
And I've got a lawyer sitting right next to me, so I'm definitely going to decline. But what I would say is the interest the interest from clients is high, without question. I mean, in every discussion, whether in terms of general market discussions, cyber's coming up, and we are getting questions from our clients. That's without question. But also from investors, we do feel as though investors are engaged and focused on the space. So it's something that we feel pretty confident is going to happen.
How important is the regulatory testing that the PRA does, and what kind of tests would you like to see? Because they did model for a cloud outage already, but a lot of disagreement about whether that was the right approach.
Shall I start?
Sure, please.
I really applaud the steps that various regulators are taking to develop and deploy cyber stress tests in the market, and the PRAs, one of the more recent ones, BMA, EIOPA has just put out at the end of last year a call for comment on some draft stress tests that they're applying. So I think the recognition of that sort of that catastrophic loss potential for cyber among the regulators is very welcome. I think the way that those regulators are going about thinking about what types of events could cause those systemic aggregation impacts across carriers' portfolios is really robust. They're doing a broad market consultations, engaging more deeply with certain providers than others to really make sure that what they are putting out to the market to test exposure levels is realistic. I'd like to see more of it. I think it would be very supportive. You know, I think having those stress tests in the market will support more capital coming into the market, per Richard's comment earlier.
Time for one last question, if anyone has one.
Yeah, thank you for the panels. My question is how you imagine people will report on the risk mitigation measures within a portfolio, so the security of the policyholders. How do you see that information being communicated to investors?
Richard, do you want to take
that? Yeah, so if I understand the question, you're asking how will, in addition to the risk analysis that an independent risk modeler will provide, how will it gross up into? So I think ultimately it has to. There's going to be a lot of work that needs to be undertaken, but we can imagine it being fairly similar to the way in which ILS investors look at the world today. Meaning they have access to risk models themselves. They individually license risk models. And they're receiving aggregated data, and they're rolling it up to understand their accumulations to certain perils. We would imagine it could ultimately be pretty simple in that sense. And one of the reasons for that is that a lot of the modelling that's getting done today on the cyber side is scenario based, and it's looking to identify the scenarios that will ultimately drive loss and what will need to happen is that investors will ultimately need to overlay their positions to generate an accumulated loss amount.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Carl. Thank you, panelists. Please put your hands together.